Us about the wonders of 802.1X, what's the matter with it and how to fix it. And in case you're wondering who he is, if you've ever heard of the Security Geeks group, he runs that and the website, mailing list, etc. It's a good place to go for info. Always good info there. So without further ado, Bruce.
Can you hear me? Holy cow, there's a lot of gain on that. That better? Alright, I don't like microphones anyway because I'm kind of loud, so if you start going deaf, I apologize. The hell with it.
Alright, how's that? Yay, all right, it's 9 o'clock, we're at Black Hat, everyone's half asleep anyway, so just ignore the guy at the microphone. I'm Bruce Potter with the Shmoo Group. First and foremost, I'll apologize, I'm fighting a cold the last couple days, so I may break off into a fit of hacking up a lung. I apologize, but it's just my way to stall and use up more time. For those that don't know, the Shmoo Group is an ad hoc group of security, crypto, and privacy professionals. We are not a formal organization, and we are not a for-profit company. We're just a bunch of geeks having fun, so I'm not up here espousing views to make money. I'm just up here to try and educate folks. As a living, I do network and security operations. I am responsible for maintaining a relatively large network and making sure data gets across it and stays intact in transit. Because of that, I am much more of a practitioner than a theoretical person or an academic. So this talk will be focused primarily on the actual operational impacts of 802.1X and not the theoretical underlying structure. I am familiar with the underlying structure, read the documents, but I wasn't there at the genesis of them. So at the Q&A, you may be able to bowl me over if you were there for that part. All right, first off, how many people know what this is a screenshot of? All right. For those that don't know, this is NetStumbler. It is a war driving tool, one of many that are currently out there. And it shows you wireless networks that you are near. It gives you their SSID, the channel they're on, whether or not they're using WEP, and what your signal is. I live in Northern Virginia, about 30 miles outside of DC. I drive 15 miles to work through what used to be farm country and is now suburban wasteland, sprinkled with office buildings with what used to be dot-coms and high-techs and now filled with leasing companies hoping to pay their rent. When I drove in September using a high-gain Omni strapped to the back seat of my car, I passed 12 access points. When I drove in May, I passed 50. So wireless deployment, it doesn't matter where you are, Northern Virginia or upstate New York, it's growing rapidly. And there, anybody can download a tool like this and just go out and find the networks. So, why wireless? No cable plan. There's a good practical reason. If I'm going to occupy a building, probably don't want to go out and have to pull cable unless I absolutely have to. It's a lower cost, but probably only initially. There are concerns that if you are deploying a wireless network in a building as a replacement for a wired network, your total cost of ownership may actually be greater in the long run. When you install Cat 5, you pull out the highest grade Cat 5, you shove it in the walls, in all likelihood, that Cat 5 is going to last for 10, 12 years. The switches that support it are probably going to be field upgradable at a reasonable price. With the wireless infrastructure, you're continually going to be upgrading technologies as things change dramatically over the next 5 years. It allows for rapid deployment. If you're coming in and have to set up a body shop of developers to code something, you can get them up and running very rapidly with wireless versus a wired network. It also allows enhanced mobility. Now, this is where we all save money because we can roam around and do everything all over our company, right? There are various figures of how much more productive employees are when they are using wireless. They vary wildly from $500 more productivity a year to $4,000 more. Really, I think it just gives them an excuse to go curl up in a corner and surf without somebody watching them, but I don't think that's really been proven yet. It also allows for the creation of ad hoc relationships. And by this, I mean people can get together and form networks and ergo a relationship very quickly, very rapidly. This has been shown by primarily a lot of the community wireless initiatives that are going on. Personal Telecom in Portland, Seattle Wireless in Seattle, New York City Wireless. If you're in Northern Virginia, there's Nova Wireless, novawireless.org. Go there, subscribe. This is a lot of people to come together at community level, hook up their access points, hook up their networks, and figure out what they're going to do with this giant network that they're building. For Seattle, they're building a network to see what people will use it for. For Personal Telco in Portland, they're hooking up hotspots so people can have internet access. These kind of ad hoc relationships are going to revolutionize the way that we compute outside of the business, in my opinion. A lot of people disagree with me. Regardless of why you're doing it, there are many different requirements. And going forward, all the talks that you hear today, you need to apply what's being said to your environment, to your risk model, to whatever it is you're trying to do with wireless, because whatever people are espousing here on stage, it is simply their experience, what they know, and how it applies to their lives. You need to take this and apply it to your situation. So, why not? Many people have chosen not to deploy wireless. They've looked at the risks and decided against it. First and foremost, no physical security. Anybody and his brother can be some arbitrary distance away from your access point and go and snoop your data. I can be in the parking lot and just using the card in my PDA, or I can be 20 miles away with a high-gain antenna on a tripod. It's trivial to pick up the raw packets. Now, if the raw packets do you any good, that's a different issue. The existing technology, 802.11b, I'll get into in a moment, is relatively low throughput. It's 11 megabits. It's also a shared medium, so rather than living in a switched environment in an office where you can have 100 people pushing 100 megabits at wire speed to your switch, you have one 11 megabit segment and everybody's contending for it. With 802.11a, you've got more bandwidth, but it's still the same shared medium. You cannot jam hundreds and hundreds of users on it and hope everything's going to work out well. It's also, all these technologies that are being deployed widely today are in unregulated bands. They're covered in various parts of FCC regulations for basically kind of open use as in low output situations. So not only does 802.11b occupy the 2.4 gigahertz space, but there are security systems that occupy 2.4 gigahertz. There are cordless phones that occupy 2.4 gigahertz. When I use my cordless phone in my house, my wireless network goes offline. I take it to use my cell phone a lot more now because I can't stand it when I can't use the internet. All my servers live behind a wireless link. So when they go down, people can't do name resolution, I can't get my mail, people can't hit my websites. So, and it's only going to get worse as time goes on as these bands become more crowded. So first, let's get through the number soup that we've got going on here. 802.11 is an IEEE standard in the whole 802 suite. 802.3 is Ethernet, wired Ethernet. I think 802.4 is FIDI or 5 is FIDI. I can't remember. Anyway, 802.11 is the one that we care about. The original 802.11 specification, without any trailing numbers or anything, was kind of a zoo. You had three different physical mediums or physical ways you can interact with the network. The 802.11 protocols are broken up into two parts. There's the physical layer, and then there's the media access layer, one above it. Effectively, layer one, your physical layer, and layer two, the MAC layer. The original 802.11 specification had frequency hopping and direct sequence for the modulation for the signals. It also had IR, which really never got deployed. You could sit in your little Dilbert cubicle and put your IR 802.11 radio up on there and bounce IR signals off your ceiling tiles in your office and transmit data at 2 megabits and just a shade where you couldn't see it. It never caught on. There are too many limitations. However, the difficulties with frequency hopping and direct sequence, they don't interplay. They don't play nice together. So with 802.11b, they standardized, said, all right, it's just direct sequence. That's it. We're not going to have all these compatibility issues where your card can't talk to my card. In all the 802.11 protocols, there's two modes you can be in. You can be in an infrastructure mode where effectively you have an access point and you have a station connecting to that access point. So many people associate up to one access point. In an ad hoc network, it's more things just kind of connect to whatever they want. There's a lot of differences, not a lot, but there are differences in the underlying protocols as far as how they're handled. But if you've ever configured your wireless card on your laptop or whatever, you'll see these modes called very different things, but this is effectively what they mean. 802.11b, like I said, they went to DSSS. It still uses WEP just like 802.11 did, and it's in the 2.4 gig range. It's up to 11 megabits, which is a big improvement over 2. And after the fiasco of the original 802.11 was, they said, hey, let's come out with a standard so people, we can make sure that everybody's playing nice together. So the Wireless Ethernet Compatibility Alliance was formed, and they certify things with their mark, which is Wi-Fi. If something is Wi-Fi compliant and got the little Wi-Fi logo stamped in the back of it, it has gone through a certification process through WECA to make sure that it will play nice with other cards and access points and whatever else has been certified. 802.11a lives in various 5 gig ranges. It is a standard today, and you can go out and buy gear. People are making it. It's still fairly expensive. 54 megabits, it uses slightly more resilient modulation to overcome any interference that will eventually show up in that band. It was going to be known as Wi-Fi 5 by WECA, and then they realized that was a little obscure, and nobody really wanted to have a number in something like Wi-Fi anyway, so they're going to rename it, God knows to what. 802.11g is where I think things are going to end up. It is a non-ratified standard, and they're still working it out, but it'll live in the 2.4 gig range. It'll have higher speed capabilities, and it will be backwards compatible with 802.11b. It's kind of a great thing, assuming we all don't buy cordless phones. All right. So the basic part of 802.11 is the association, and I'm just going to run through this just so you, for the folks that don't have this knowledge yet. An association is basically where a client connects to an access point. The client requests to authenticate with access point. The access point can say, all right, let's do web authentication, or it's just open, let's just run with it. If there's web authentication, there's a technical little transaction that occurs to make sure everyone has the same key. And once it's successful, then it requests the association and it's granted. So that's the process that it has to go through. It's usually a very quick process, and it's localized in general on between the access point and the station. There aren't third parties involved. This becomes important later when we start talking about roaming and how 802.1x affects that. Something to note, there are all kinds of little security things you can dial in on your access point. The SSID, you can choose not to send 802.11 beacon frames, so people don't really know that you're there. It doesn't make any difference, because when you associate, they're sent in the clear anyway in the management frame. So anyone with half a brain who's out there running a packet sniffer can see what SSID you just associated to. So it's one of those things that raises the bar, but it definitely doesn't make your network invisible. All right, why are we here? Security people deal with the three basics every day, right? We never go off and play Unreal Tournament or anything silly like that. Integrity, confidentiality, and availability. Integrity, you really want to make sure nobody's modifying what's on your network, fiddling around, saying that you maybe booked an extra couple $1 billion in earnings when you really didn't. That'll be the next company that comes out and they say, oh, we were hacked. Somebody screwed us. Confidentiality. You want to keep people off your network. You want to keep them from gaining anything useful. Physical security is a wash. People can sniff the data. You just want to make sure that when they sniff it, it doesn't mean anything to them. It doesn't get them anywhere. You also want to keep people off your network for several liability reasons. There was a gentleman in Houston, I believe, who was just arrested for hacking a courtroom from their wireless network. He's going to be in a bit of hot water, I think. When you stand up a wireless network, you need to understand where it is in your network and how it's architected to make sure people aren't going to use that as a jumping point into your network. They also want to make sure that they're not going to use it as a jumping point to the internet to get free internet access, because that a lot of people consider that a theft of service. Other people consider it the way it should be. Not going to debate that today. There's also the chance that you can go out and hack somebody else's network. A hacker drives up, sits in your parking lot, uses your wireless access point to go and hack a company 3,000 miles away. 2 days later, the feds are at your door saying, what are you doing? And you have no clue what's going on. 4 days later, you're fired. Availability. Availability, a low-level DOS is inevitable. There are all kinds of ways to take down wireless networks, and some of them interesting, some of them are coat hangers and microwaves, effectively. It doesn't make a lot of difference. You gotta do your best and give people a dial-up account for the times when it really gets bad. Like any other environment, there's no one solution to anything. 802.1x, as I'll show you, is a part of a solution, but you need to understand what is good and bad about it, what it can and can't do, so you can apply it properly to your situation. Don't assume anything that a vendor tells you that will solve all your problems. So what's the state of the art today? What are people generally doing to secure themselves? One, people are using WEP. WEP operates at the link level, tries to provide wired equivalent privacy between you and the access point. It is very broken, and not just the cryptography. As a lot of people know, the cryptography of WEP has been shattered. You can happily, you know, get the keys out if you capture enough data, blah, you know, lots of papers on it, whatever. It's also administratively difficult. There's a lot of issues with key management in WEP that I'll get into in a minute that really make it difficult to administer at an enterprise level. People are also doing MAC filtering. MAC filtering's great and all, but every card on the planet can have its MAC address changed effectively. If you've got a FreeBSD box, go plug in a Prism 2 based card, ifconfig, an Ethernet address, POW, and it'll just take the new Ethernet address and be all happy. So MAC filtering raises the bar, but isn't a silver bullet either. People use firewalls, obviously. There's reactionary measures. The idea of a portal, it's what they were running here at Caesars until 2 days ago, where you go to it, you have to log in with your credit card information or some kind of credential that say, yes, I'm a valid person, and then everything can go out and use the network. There's also the idea of inverting the portal so that you have an IDS, which allows all traffic out until I see something nefarious. And when something goes wrong and I see someone trying to hack somebody else, I just chop them off at the knees, I block their IP, block their MAC, alert everybody, and try to keep the network intact. Beyond that, people are obviously using higher level protocols. They're using SSL, SSH, IPsec to secure their transactions. In a nutshell, this is WEP, packets, initialization vectors, blah. What's really interesting is a WEP key that's 64 bits long has 24 bits of known key material. A WEP key that's 128 bits long also has 24 bits of known key material. So you really don't have an RC4 key that's 64 bits long. You have a 40-bit long key, which already has proven to be problematic because you can brute force that. And then what's really interesting, once you get all the crypto issues involved with WEP, effectively the key length doesn't cause the difficulty to scale exponentially like in a normal cryptographic environment. It scales linearly. So to double the difficulty to crack the key via brute force, instead of having, say, to add 1 bit to the key, you have to add double the number of bits. So really, the 128 bits of WEP security doesn't get you much beyond the 40. So a quick thought on WEP. Key management is just a fiasco. Everybody's got to have the keys. It's a shared secret. You either have to trust them implicitly or actually explicitly, or you have to have total control of the workstations accessing your network. And even in enterprises where they try to exercise total control over their workstations, it doesn't work out. There have been several companies that have come out in the last year that sent messages to their employees, please stop giving your WEP keys to your friends to use. They are using our network, and we have no idea who they are. Several large Bay corporations are just, you know, hey, friends, family coming to use their internet connection because somebody's given out their WEP key. Key lifetime could get very short. Given the fact that people know the keys and there's, you know, hacks against them and whatever, key lifetime becomes a function of the number of packets transmitted with that key. If you've got a large network and with a whole bunch of people using the same key, then suddenly your key lifetime gets very short because it doesn't take very long to generate a lot of packets. So doing fast key rotation is very difficult. There is no authentication for management frames. This is a great thing. Someone's associated to an access point, I can spoof a packet that's sourced from the access point's MAC that says, deassociate, gone. That's it. No authentication, nothing. One of the biggest problems, no matter what people layer on top of it, there's not a lot of issues today that address the management frame authentication issue. There's no per packet auth. I authenticate myself in the beginning, but beyond that, there's basically just integrity checking to make sure that it's really no bits have been twiddled in the middle. It was the original packet, but really have no idea who sent the packet. There's no concept of per packet authentication yet. And finally, WEP is really just false advertising. It's not wired equivalent anything unless you consider giving all your neighbors access to your hub in your computer room to be wired equivalent. Here, why don't you see what I'm sending? So what's lacking? Scalability. How to make this thing grow to a reasonable size. How to make it grow to something that works beyond 20 people who trust each other implicitly. Many clients, how do you make wireless scale to handle an enterprise the size of Microsoft, Sun, Cisco, the state of California, something like that. You also want to protect all parties. As we'll see later, the client gets forgotten about a lot. The client's hung out there to dry. The access point, usually a little firmware device, not very interesting. Maybe it has SNMP running. Hopefully, they've changed the default community string. Beyond that, it just sits there. There's not a lot of interesting things you can do to it to really exploit it. But you've got 15 guys whose titles start with director of and usually end in marketing running around with open shares and other idiocy on their laptops. And those are the people that you really need to worry about protecting, because they're the nice big juicy steak for someone who's looking to attack you. Really, at the end of the day, we're trying to eliminate invalid trust assumptions. Through all these protocols, either trust assumptions were ignored, never thought of, or just kind of assumed it wasn't going to be that big of a deal. You need to know who you're trusting, who you're not trusting, and develop protocols and deploy networks that will map that trust into the real world. Without doing that, it's just all academic. Okay, so, you know, right, 20 minutes into it, and there's a first slide, so it's 802.1x. No problem. 802.1x, it was developed for campuses. It was not developed for wireless. This is not a wireless protocol. This is a protocol that was designed for a campus environment where I'm a network administrator. I have 5,000 ports wired directly to my Catalyst 6500 infrastructure, and they're all live and handing out DHCP addresses. Great. Anybody can come up and plug into that network, get access, and go rummage around and do anything they want. It was a real nightmare. You know, the ideas that the network administrators were coming up, you could do MAC filtering. Hey, that's great. I want to maintain a list of 20,000 MAC addresses. This is something I'm very interested in doing. They had a quandary. So Cisco, Microsoft, I believe Intel, those are the big players, all kind of got together in this IEEE task force, and poof, out popped 802.1x. It's port-based authentication. It allows me to hopefully verify who or what is trying to connect to a port to then eventually give them access to the network in a way that is amiable to me and on my terms. It was then said, hey, you know, this is really great, and it sounds like some problems we're having with wireless. Let's use this in the wireless environment and see what happens. It worked out okay. There are some issues, and some things worked out, some things didn't. We'll get into that in a minute. It allows for unified AAA services. Authentication, authorization, and auditing. Dear God. If we ever get beyond authentication, we're doing good, right? Authorization, try to explain authorization to your boss. What the difference between authentication and authorization is, good luck. It allows for authorization. It allows you to say what you can do and what you can't do, and it also allows for a means to track that information. It also provides a means for key transport. I can ship web keys with 802.1x. Note, this is not part of the specification. The specification gives me a little spot where it says arbitrary data goes here. And you can ship arbitrary data to the client. It doesn't say wet data goes here. So there's still standards that needed to be developed and are being developed that will ship key material back to the client. All right, so in a wireless network, we've got three parties. Ignoring the labels at the top, standard wireless network, you've got a laptop there, which is known as a station, you've got an access point known as an access point, and then you've got this other wired line network with services running off of it. In 802.1x, things take on a different name. So in 802.1x, you've got a supplicant, which is effectively something that runs on the client machines that handles the 802.1 authentication for them. You've got an authenticator, which originally was a switch and has now become an access point. It is effectively a pass-through for the 802.1x traffic. And then there's an authentication server back at home base that allows you to actually do the real authentication and verify the supplicant is really who he says it is. So this is all well and good. How does it all happen? Well, first of all, in the pre-authentication state, the only thing you can do is talk to the authentication server. You can't do anything else. You don't go to a port 80 HTTP portal. You don't do anything else interesting. This is a kind of like a lower level portal concept where you can send data, but the only thing you end up being able to do is talk to the authentication server. Once you've authenticated, hey, look, I can get to whatever they said it was I was supposed to be able to get to. So you've kind of got this gate situation where the gate doesn't close or open, depending if you're a double E major or not. The gate doesn't close until you end up properly authenticating. So how do you authenticate? Great question. Thanks for asking. EAP, Extensible Authentication Protocol. Again, this was a protocol that wasn't designed for wireless networks. It was designed for PPP. It was, I believe, trying to overcome some security issues with CHAP and had nothing to do. There was no little glimmer of a wireless thing in its mind at the time. It is kind of like XML for authentication people. It allows you to bootstrap in anything that you want to do, any way of authentication you want to use, into a stream. It's kind of interesting, actually. It was shoehorned into Air 2.1x to solve their authentication problem. Shoehorn maybe is a little heavy-handed. It's, I think, a very good application for a wired line 802.1x implementation. So the switch of the access point becomes a pass-through for EAP traffic. There's kind of overlying encapsulation that needs to be handled by the access points, but the EAP traffic will transparently move through the access point. This is very important. The designers of 802.1x wanted to make sure that when they deployed this, when they got this protocol out, it needed to be not require a hardware upgrade. It needed to be very lightweight. So they're willing to deal with a firmware upgrade, that's no problem, but a hardware upgrade was out of the question. So the idea is 802.1x using EAP, since it's just a pass-through, it doesn't care what the underlying authentication mechanism is. The access point doesn't need to know how to do passwords or one-time passwords or any other nonsense like that. It just says, okay, I'll hand this off. So what this has allowed is if you've got an infrastructure of Catalyst 6500s, I just go load a new version of iOS and, hey, look, it's 802.1x compliant. Wow, and that's all there is to it. Leap. It's the first, not the first, but it's one of the most widely deployed EAP methods right now. It's password-based, and it's Cisco's proprietary whatever, but Cisco proprietary generally means that they'll kind of give out the specs and people can code against it, and they pray to God people do. The de facto mechanism of transport between the authentication server and the authenticator is Radius. Radius is actually kind of a nice little thing because Radius has all kinds of AAA services already embedded in it. You can send stop and start records, reasons for termination, you can tell people what they can and can't do, and you can create arbitrary data constructs to say, hey, look, there's a field that starts with blah, and in this field there's going to be this data, and I can pass that over, say maybe a web key or something interesting like that. All right, so how does this all work? The first step of this can be initiated by either the access point or the client. The access point can say, hey, let's do some EAP stuff. Or the client can send an EAP start and say, hey, you know what, I'm here, why don't you pay attention to me? The supplicant then sends back some credentials, and then depending on the method that you're using, which I'll get into in a minute, the different methods you can use, there's various back and forth challenge responses going between the client and the authentication server, so people can verify who they are. Once the authentication server is sufficiently happy with what's been passed around, it punts it back to the access point and says, hey, this guy's been successful, or hey, he's failed, don't let him on. And maybe, hey, here's a web key to give to him. You know, this is the ultimate dream. Here's a bunch of arbitrary data to go load up in your client to make things better. Wow, this thing resonates very well. All right, so different EAP methods. EAP, TLS. TLS, SSL v3, effectively. It's just the fancy name and depends on whose side of the ballpark you're on. If you're with Microsoft or you're with VeriSign or whoever else, you'll call this different things. Effectively, it's SSL v3. It uses certs. And if implemented properly, it'll solve some problems that I'll get into later. Certificate-based stuff is generally nice because it requires trusted third parties to be in there. You can usually do client and server-side authentication. This is not client and server-side in the case of a generic HTTPS transaction, but it gives you the ability to basically authenticate both ends of a transaction, regardless of if it's an EAP transaction or you're buying books on Amazon. Okay, next one, TTLS. This is effectively, you set up your TLS connection via EAP. So you've got EAP over LAN, which is the connection between the client and the access point. And then you've got EAP encapsulating something else like Radius between the access point and the authentication server. So in the middle of that, you create this TLS tunnel. And then underneath that, in that TLS tunnel, now that I've got an authentication channel, I can pass anything I want, in theory, because it's encrypted. I can send clear text passwords, but since they're in that TLS tunnel, then I don't care. So it allows me to kind of bootstrap in existing authentication mechanisms up into EAP TLS. PEEP is very similar to TTLS, except for instead of using any arbitrary authentication mechanism, it can have, say, any EAP method shoved up into it. So it's a little bit more confined, but it's the same general idea. They require certs. Great. We all have PKIs, right? I have a cert server for my family. My son was born, and 5 minutes later, the doctor signed a cert for me, and that was it. PKI, 5 years ago, everyone thought as a matter of course we'd all have PKI infrastructures. When your employees came, you'd have a badge with a little smart chip in it, and it would have their certificate on it, and that's how you got around, and everything would be great and dandy, and it just hasn't happened. In the commercial world, these solutions are very expensive, they're difficult to administer, they're very expensive, and they're very expensive. Not just from a purchasing standpoint, but just from a manpower. Keeping these things up, doing it correctly, is a real pain in the butt. In the open source world, we've got OpenSSL, which is a great product, but it's a hell of a way to run a CA. There's not a lot of great ways to run a CA, at least not transparently. John Viega and Crew's book on OpenSSL just came out from O'Reilly's. Actually got a nice little homebrewed how to run a CA, and here's a bunch of supporting scripts, so it isn't such a pain in the butt. So if you are interested in running an OpenSSL-based CA, I recommend picking that book up. And finally, you know, you've got to use certs properly, which is a whole other software engineering issue that I'll get to in a minute. All right, so what's right? Well, the guys on the campus are happy. The wire network is protected. You've protected the infrastructure effectively with 802.1x. The authentication mechanisms can change as needed. Again, very good. If I'm using 64-bit RC4 keys inside my authentication mechanism, and now I can upgrade, and really not much has to change. You add a little bit to the clients, you add something to the authentication server, the access point stays the same, pow, done. And it does address some flaws in the existing 802.11 security issues. It gives you authentication, maybe not the perfect, but it does give you some decent authentication. It's also very lightweight. This is nice. You're not running an extra 24 bits of data for every packet that you send across your network. Wireless networks already have a throughput problem. The last thing you want to do is go pad packets with data every time they go through. You come into a network, you authenticate via 802.1x, at some time later, T plus 60 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever, you say, let's re-authenticate. This does two things. One, it allows you to verify who is connected periodically to make sure it's still the same person. It also allows you to do things like rekey them if they're using WEP. So going down the road, 802.1x will be the mechanism, in all likelihood, that we can do WEP rekeying with on a fairly regular basis. This is, though, however, a problem because in 10 minutes' time, there's always room for someone to come in and take you offline and have some fun with you. Continuing on with the right side of things, in a control environment, you can always use IPsec, you can always use SSL, you can always use, well, SSH is, you know, for us. There are very few people outside of organizations like this that will use SSH on a daily basis. My mom is not going to go out and do an SSH tunnel to her ISP to get her mail, I'm sorry. SSL is okay. VPNs are obviously a little bit of a catch-all. In a closed environment like an enterprise, it works fine. In an open environment like a public access network, it doesn't really work. The exchange of the WebKey material is not part of the 802.1x specification. So here's a kind of the gray area. The 802.1x transaction happens after I associate. So if I'm using WEP authentication in my association process, that at least shows they have knowledge of the WEP key. Okay, this is nice. You know, they know something. You know, even if they've hacked it, okay, raised the bar enough, they know something. The problem is, there's two problems. One, how do you manage that default key? These people, if they're going to use that WEP key to get onto the network to do the 802.1x authentication, assuming even you're using 802.1x to ship them their WEP key, how do you get them that first one? How do you get them the zeroth key? Well, there's still some trust involved there. Either you have explicit control of the workstation and they can't see it, or you trust everyone, and then you make sure they rotate off that key as soon as they authenticate in. It's just not really practical yet. But if you are using WEP today, it will diminish some of the vulnerabilities I'll bring up later. All right, so now we get to the good stuff. What's wrong? The guys at the University of Maryland came up with not only holes in 802.1x and various problems with it, but they also wrote the open source supplicant, and well, as far as I know, the only open source supplicant and the only open source authenticator out there. So you can download their supplicant, install it in your OpenBSD box. You can download their authenticator, install it on your Linux box running host AP, and then download FreeRadius, which understands a couple EAP methods, including EAP MD5 and EAP TLS. And look, you have a completely open source 802.1x network. So for that, I'm very grateful. I'm also very grateful. They've written some very good papers, some interesting papers on RC4 cracks on WEP, as well as the holes in 802.1x. What they discovered is one of the biggest problems is explicitly there's only one-way authentication. You are only authenticating the access point. You're only authenticating the client. Ignore what I just said. You're only authenticating the client. The access point can be rogue. You have no way of really knowing. You can layer on things like EAP TLS, do mutual authentication, and then you have ways of verifying the access point, or at least the infrastructure that it's attached to. It is not a implicit mutual authentication. This is a problem. Again, the client's the weak link in the mess, and protecting the infrastructure may save your job, but it doesn't save your marketing documents that are on your marketing droid's laptop. Traffic interception and session hijacking. So, all right, one-way authentication. Obviously, the person in a wireless network, everyone is kind of bound to these things called SSIDs. I put in an SSID of Black Hat, and I sit here and I'm happily using the network. Somebody else stands up a rogue access point with the SSID of Black Hat, and my client, quite frankly, doesn't know the difference. The only way it knows to determine whether to use A or B is who's speaking the loudest to me. Who do I have the strongest signal to? So if I want to have the strongest signal to someone in the front row running a wireless network right now, I can point a directional antenna at him, and I guarantee I'm going to blow the hell out of that access point. I'm going to be a lot louder than him. Pow, I win. I'm now, as far as he's concerned, I'm the Black Hat network. So it's a trivial matter to become a rogue gateway in an 802.1x, in any network, an 802.11 network. Again, there's still no authentication in the management frames. So once I'm authenticated, I can just punt you off the network. It doesn't matter if you've gone through all this glorious authentication. I can say, hey, why don't you go deassociate, and that's the end of it. All right, so man in the middle. There's a really interesting quirk in the state machine of 802.1x that the Maryland guys found. You can send, without any prior questions, authentication successful to the client, and it says, okay, and it will talk to that access point. It doesn't need to have asked for it, really. You can just tell it, hey, guess what? Everything's good. Oh, thanks. And it goes running off to you. This is a very odd feature, and it happens because of the way that EAP and 802.1x state machines kind of play together. And at some point, things just kind of get lost, and you can just say, oh, hey, look, you can talk to me now, and your client will happily obey. Hijacking, again. I speak very loudly to a client and tell him to I send him a deassociate. I'm done with you, Beacon. I just keep sending these packets at him so he can't try to associate. Then I take his MAC address and I associate to the, or I don't need to associate. I take his MAC address, and as far as the access point's concerned, I'm already associated. So I don't need to go through the whole process again. I just act like everything's fine. So here's this guy, he went through all the work. He did a little association at 802.11, and then he did an 802.1x authentication. He did all this work, and then I knocked him off the network, and I just took his connection form. Hey, look at me, I'm this guy. I'll get into trouble when 802.1x says, hey, it's timeout time, why don't you tell me who you are again? Maybe then I'll let him back on the network for a couple minutes to do his thing, and then I'll kick him back off and take his connection again. So you could just do this until it gets boring and you've hacked all the Norwegian sites you feel like, and then you can go away. All right. So there's some other technical things that kind of start popping up. Radius, it's a great system, but it generally still uses a shared secret. So when you've got a Radius server up and running, your Radius server has a secret that you end up pushing out to your access point. And again, it's the trust model issue. Do you trust your access points? In general, your access points are probably run by the same people, or at least moderately trustworthy people, that are running the authentication server. So this is okay, but not the best thing. There's also roaming issues. You know, wireless isn't just associating to one access point, as far as most people are concerned. It allows you to roam transparently from one to another. As I'm being productive and I'm going from the conference room to the bathroom, And I'm not going off the network, and I'm roaming from one access point to another, and I'm playing, say, Unreal Tournament, I'll suddenly get this big lag right in the middle when I have to associate to an access point, which isn't that big of a deal, but then I have to go through an 802.1x authentication transaction again, which means that I end up talking to a Radius server that's somewhere else in the network. Hell, it could be on another coast, depending on how you've architected your network. There can be a substantial lag there. And if it's a big process and there's some certificate, you know, public key cryptography involved, it may take 2 or 3 seconds. And as soon as your connection comes back to life, you've been annihilated by some guy and you're really pissed off. They're working out ways of overcoming this, but it's a pretty serious issue if you're looking for transparent real-time roaming. There's going to be a lag if you use 802.1x. Also note, the Radius server is kind of important. If the Radius server goes offline, people can't use your network. This is kind of bad. It's weird that you can have a failure that's not the switch to the router or whatever. You have this other server off to the side, and if it goes nuts, everybody's dead. Not only if it goes nuts, you look at it two ways. How do you get high availability in the situation? Well, the access points can be configured to use 2 Radius servers. A lot of them probably can be, but it's not very robust. They don't really understand quite when the ones failed. And most Radius servers don't have transparent failover. So you can go out and buy things like a big IP and do load balancing between your Radius servers, and that gets really cheap really fast, right? You know, spend 40 grand on a big IP cluster. All right, great. So what really happened here? You know, there's some technical stuff, but they forgot about the client. When I'm on a wireless network, everybody is at risk. Everybody and his brother is out there hung out on a wire, and or without a wire, frankly, and can get nailed. And you can also be a threat. I don't know anyone else in this network. I know maybe 20 people here at this conference, and that means there's probably 98% of the people here I don't know, and I don't trust any of you to be snooping around in the wireless network and looking at what I'm doing. But yet, I'm sure many of you are right now, as we speak, snooping around in the wireless network. And if you're going to DEF CON, it'll be even worse. As Jeff said, if you use clear text anything, you'll get what you ask for. And at DEF CON, your family will probably get it as well. So the lack of physical security is kind of what broke 802.1x. In a wired environment where you assumed it was generally secure, it worked out pretty well. In a wireless environment, it didn't work out so hot. But if you're using web, at the beginning, you can overcome some of these issues as long as you have decent web management. The protocol was designed not to have to go out and replace all my switches with new gear, not upgrade my supervisor modules, yada, yada, yada. What that meant is they were kind of constrained is what they could do. You know, we can do this thing that requires authentication every X number of minutes, but we can't do something that requires authentication on a per packet basis necessarily, because that may require a lot more hardware than we were ready to design for. So there were some trade-offs. Given their threat model, which was a wired environment, it worked out okay. In wireless, this is maybe not the best solution. Okay, extensibility leads to complexity. This is like a general software engineering issue. If you make something very flexible and very easy, you know, robust, and you can do everything, it slices it, dices it, whatever, it'll also cut your finger off. If you give a developer a big tool and say, let's go write something based on this extensible framework, and invariably they're going to pull out the shotgun and take their foot off. XML, hey, you know, it's great, but it's also this big rat's nest of you need to know what you're doing. EAP is kind of the same thing. Unless you understand what you're doing, you can shoot yourself. Development of protocols is something that generally takes a long time and is done by very smart people. It is not done by someone half a year out of their CES program at some local community college and working at, you know, $30,000 a year and just gets a requirement and it says add authentication mechanism here. He goes off and reads the very interesting Microsoft guide on developing EAP methods, is confused out of his gourd, decides that everyone's password will be Bob, and codes it, and then he runs away. So you need to understand what you're trying to do when you're using EAP. Multi-vendor support is difficult. There were 4 or 5 different standards I put up on the board there. There's 4 or 5 other 6, 7, 8, 9, 20 other EAP methods that are coming out. And that means that as a client, the machine needs to understand how to do all these things. Your authentication server needs to understand how to do all these things. In a small enclosed enterprise, great. You can control the ends. Awesome. As things grow and things become larger and harder to maintain, interoperability is going to be a bit of a pain in the butt. in general, don't shoehorn protocols into where they don't belong. This is not just a wireless thing. This is a general security practice. This goes for protocols that are on the wire. This goes for human protocols where you have some. Don't take protocols and shove them somewhere without a full understanding of what it is you're trying to do, and also, if possible, what it is you may want to do in 2 years. If wireless is getting big, maybe we want to think about how this is going to play into the wireless world. Nah, screw it. We'll just think about the cables. All right. So, obviously, things weren't designed for the right reasons. Don't apply old protocols unless you know what you're doing. Radius, so far, has worked out pretty well for them, though. So, where are we today? We've got several 802.x supplicant implementations. There's XP. Every version of XP, home, professional, whatever, has 1x support. Awesome. There's also the supplicant from open1x.org. I believe Cisco's got a supplicant for OS 10 and some other stuff. What's really kind of interesting is this. This is my compact iPack with a card jacked in the end of it. I would consider this a high-risk environment. I'm roaming around. I'm using a PDA, which is the ultimate mobility device. This is the ultimate mobility device with the ultimate operating system for mobility, and it doesn't support 802.1x. It also has horrific certificate support. If you go try and download for, say, a new root cert, you know, your company has its own CA, and you've got your own root cert you need to import, you can't import it on here. It has no earthly idea how to do it. You can do it, I believe, if you're a developer and you want to code things up and do some nasty stuff, but I can't just go to a website and click download root cert. Doesn't know. It also doesn't handle CRLs for squat. I downloaded the VeriSign Class 1 CRL. Saved it to flash memory. It had no clue what to do with it. This is a high-risk environment, and it is one of the. It's taken 4 years step back as far as roaming mobile security is concerned. It's going to have to change. If you're developing applications, if you're using applications in a high-risk environment, you need to understand the risk. This, a laptop with 802.1x is great, but its little brother designed for the high-risk environment sucks. EAP implementations. What servers understand EAP methods? Not what EAP methods do they understand, but at least they have a concept of what's going on, EAP encapsulated in Radius. Windows IIS, Free Radius understands MD5 and TLS, so you can be a normal person and do MD5 and do a password-based, or you can get really ambitious and run your own CA and do TLS. Cisco and I believe steel-belted Radius and some others support some EAP methods at this point. Okay, so what 802.1x capable access points are there? There's a whole bunch now. The higher end ones from the big players have them. Cisco pushes this like it's going out of style. Lucent has support for it on the AP500, 1000, 2000. You can also take your RG1000, which are those little iron looking things. They got three blinky lights. They look like a really squashed down iron. Costs like $120 on Amazon. You can take those and you can upgrade them with the AP500 firmware, and suddenly they become 802.1x capable. They're the same, practically the same gear inside. They're same enough that the firmware works. You do lose the ability to dial out if you're using the modem of the RG1000, and you lose the ability to do NATing or some nonsense. But if you're just using your access point as an Ethernet bridge like most people are, it works great. So if you've got one, go play with it. You can use Freebase, which is a great utility for managing all these Lucent-based access points, like an Apple Airport is the same as an RG1000. So you can also do the same little trick with that. And then there's the OS authenticator, the open source authenticator from 802.1x that you can run on your Linux box. So what's next? You want to do everything you can to protect yourself, right? Assuming you're not lazy and you want to do everything you can that won't get you fired. I know there's a fine line there where, hey, it's secure enough that I can go off and just not do anything for a while and act like a security guy with a big hat on and smile a lot. One thing that's really interesting is a friend of mine, Brian, who's here, I'm not sure if he's in the audience, but he was discussing some research he had done looking into what the legal ramifications of running WEP were. If you're running wet, that is effectively a do not disturb sign on your door. Do not trespass on my property. If someone goes through the hassle of hacking up, figuring out your web key using AirSnort or something like that, they've gone above and beyond a casual person roaming around with their XP box who happened to associate it and picked up a DHCP and, oh, I didn't know I was using your network. This person has really gone out to do something malicious. That do not trespass sign is your key to possibly doing some prosecution to this person. Now, if you find him, that's a whole different issue. If he's sitting in the parking lot in a beat-up Volkswagen Beetle next to all the other Lexuses that are parked out there, he might be a glaring spot. He can go get him. But beyond that, it gives you that tool. So using things like 1X and Weapon, whatever, even if they're not perfect, they provide you at least some legal recourse. Maybe not technical if for the smart people, but the legal recourse. And technically, frankly, it raises the bar enough that if I get to a network and it's web encrypted and they're using 1X, they're doing MAC filtering, blah, 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 I'm going to go 100 yards down the road and use somebody else's network. I'm not going to sit here. Unless I'm targeting this company for some reason, I'm not going to just fiddle around with that when I can just go down the road. 802.11i is the task group formed to try and kind of throw together all the security issues that popped out with 802.11. They are, in my mind, on the right track. Bunch of smart people, they understand what they're trying to get done, and they are really going to solve some problems by the time the I task group is done. 802.1x will be part of the I specification, at least at this point. They're looking at doing mutual authentication, mandatory, they're looking at per packet authentication, they're looking at lots of very interesting things, but we probably won't see the fruits of their labor standardized for quite some time, year or two maybe. Frankly, web has the right idea. It was pretty simple to, you know, hey, look, I enter in some data and then I have wired equivalent privacy. Wired equivalent privacy is what we're all gunning for. I would like to be able to sit in this room with thousands of people I don't trust and go off and use a wireless network in the manner that I thought was reasonably secure. And I think that that's what we're all shooting for. It's going to be a while, though. And then solutions like SSL and SSH, like I said, don't really work in general. They'll work in specific circumstances where you control things, but in general, they're not going to fly. Temporal key integrity protocol, something worth mentioning. This is part of the 802.11i task group. They are looking at doing fast packet keying and dynamic rekeying, which are effectively just different ways of changing your web key in very short periods of time in ways that make sense to the rest of the network. They're also looking at doing packet-based MAC to make sure that the packet not only has integrity but comes from the person who actually was supposed to send it, and like I said, the key distribution by 802.1x. So that's all being rolled up into TKIP. Maybe third quarter, maybe fourth quarter, we'll start seeing some products out with that, even though 802.11i won't be finished. TKIP may be solid enough that vendors will all run ahead and go start playing with it. They tried to do the same thing with 802.11g. Vendors went out and they, hey, look, we got G cards. And everyone said, what are you on, crack? The IEEE came out and slapped them. And it wasn't a ratified standard. Don't go out saying that you're using something that's not even a standard yet. That's the way we're going to get in trouble. You know, if someone starts going out and deploying things before the IEEE says, yeah, it's final, let's put a bow on it, people are going to get burned. We're going to end up with interoperability problems. We'll take 2 years backstep in time. And eventually, we'll all be using AES, because everything else is just silly, right? RC4 is deployed, obviously, in mass right now in existing web installations. AES will eventually supplant it in the wireless world, and AES will eventually supplant triple desk and everything else everywhere else. So get used to it, but it's still going to take some time. That's all I've got, and I believe we're just about at time. Are there any questions? We've got 5 minutes, I guess. We got any questions in the audience? The question regards the how web keys scale as you add bits of key material. The issue is, in a normal key, say I've got a 64-bit key, and it takes X amount of time to brute force to go through all 64 combinations. If I add one more bit to that key, I've doubled the possible values for the key material. So it takes me twice as long to hack that key. With WEP, if I add another bit, it increases it a little bit. If I got a 64-bit key and I want to make it twice as difficult to hack, I have to make it a 128-bit key, effectively. You don't get the advantage where you add a bit or two and it gets a lot harder. You have to add a lot more bits to make it harder. And that means there's a lot more computation involved when you have more bits to actually do the crunching for the decryption and encryption. Does that make sense? Okay. People are egressing for food, so I think I'll let it fly here. Anyway, the presentation's there. It's probably going to be on the Blackout website. Appreciate y'all for coming.